The next days were, if possible, a worse nightmare. The Littles could not understand any of the restrictions. Hazel struggled to keep them separated, as the Raiders demanded, to keep them engaged with appropriate toys, to keep the compartment clean enough, herself decent, and still figure out how to make the garments the Raiders demanded she furnish for herself and the little girls. She had never sewn anything in her life. She had seen Donya using the sewing machine to create artworks they sold when they stopped at Corian, but clothes came from shops, or in emergencies, the fabricator. You put in the measurements, dialed the style, and out came clothes. She had no idea how to turn flat cloth into the tube-like garment in the picture the Raiders showed her. It wasn't a practical garment anyway. Snug tubes for the arms, a long one covering her from armpits to ankles. No one could sit comfortably, walk comfortably, climb and play and do things in a shape like that. But she didn't argue. She struggled to figure out the odd implements in the sewing kit. Dangerous, thin, sharp bits of metal that had no place around small children. Reels of fine thread, scissors. A long tape marked off in sections that corresponded to no measuring system she knew. A short metal strip, also marked in sections, with a sliding part. Sewing by hand was much harder than it looked, though when she figured out that the tiny, cup-shaped thing would fit over her finger and protect it from pricks of the long, sharp thing that the thread fit through, she got along better. The fabric seemed to have a mind of its own. It shifted around as she tried to poke through it. But finally, she had a long, straight skirt attached to the bottom of her pullover and skirts on the girls' shirts. They hated them and pulled them up around their waists to play. But that, it turned out, was something else forbidden to girls.
You were reared among heathen. We know that. We make allowances for it. But you're among decent folk now. You must learn to act like decent folk. It is forbidden for any female to show herself off to men. These girl babies must be decently covered at all times.
Hazel bobbed her head. She had to protect the Littles, and she could do that only by being there. Being able to sing them to sleep, to comfort them in a murmur that grew softer day by day. She had no idea how much time had passed when the daily visitor first took the boys out of the compartment. By then, of course, the Raiders knew all the children's names. At first, Paolo and Driss hung back, but the man simply gathered them up and carried them out. Hazel was terrified. What would they do to the boys? But in the time it took to feed the girls their lunch, the boys were back, grinning from ear to ear. Each held a new toy. Paolo had a toy spaceship, and Driss had a set of brightly colored beads.
We had fun!
We can talk. They said so. The boys can talk all they want. It's only the girls who have to be quiet.
Gimme!
No, this is mine. Girls can't play with boys' toys.
After that, day by day, the boys were weaned away from the girls. Daily visits outside the compartment. They returned with glowing reports. They could run up and down the corridors. They could use the swings in the gym. They could use the computer in the schoolroom. The men fed them special foods, treats. The men were teaching them. The men read to them from books, new books, stories about animals and boys and exciting stuff. They were gone hours a day now, returning to the compartment only for baths and bed. Hazel was left with the girls, the two dolls, and the endless sewing.
You teach those girl babies to sew. They're old enough for that.
They didn't want to learn, but that made no difference. Hazel realized that.
But no books at all? No vid? No computers? No chance to run and play?
She didn't ask. She didn't dare. She didn't even dare tell them stories, the stories they knew, because the compartment was rigged for scan. She had been warned to talk no more than necessary. Telling them stories would, she knew without asking, be breaking the rules. The days dragged by. Stassi, though younger, was better with needle and thread than Brandy. Her stitches were ragged and uneven, but she could get them lined up into a sort of row. Brandy, more active by nature, fretted and fumed. Her thread kept getting into knots. Hazel tried to find ways to let the child work off her wild energy, But in that small space and hampered by a long skirt, the child was constantly being frustrated. Hazel would like to have had a screaming tantrum of her own, and only the Littles' need for her kept her quiet. Brunn Meager exchanged the squad of royal security guards for 10 of her father's personal militia from Cerealis with considerable relief. She had known some of these people for years, and although she would rather have traveled alone, this was the next best situation. With them, she visited the All Systems Leasing Office and chose a roomy private yacht for the next stage of her journey. If she was not going to have Fleet's respect anyway, there was no reason to endure discomfort. She chose the highest-priced food and entertainment package and paid extra for an accelerated load and clearance that would get her on her way quickly. All Systems checked her licenses and those of the militia who would act as crew, and in less than 24 hours, she had undocked and headed for her first destination. From now until the opening day of the hunt on Cerealis, she was free of schedules and demands, except those she chose for herself. Since it was handy, relatively, she decided to check out her holdings within the Boros Consortium. It was something her father would approve of, the kind of grown-up, mature behavior he claimed she didn't show often enough, and it was a long, long way from Castle Rock. She spent 2 days with the accountants at Podge, feeling virtuous and hard-working as she waded through stacks of numbers, and then decided to skip Corian, where there would be more news media since it was a shipping hub, and go straight to Bizarre. Brunn plotted the course, calculated the times, and scowled at the figures. If she went to Bizarre by any of the standard green-lined routes, she wouldn't have time to visit Rotterdam before the start of the hunting season on Cerealis. But she was determined to visit Lady Cecilia and discuss with that other adventurous lady those things which she could not say to her parents. She could skip Bizarre, but she didn't want to skip Bizarre. She looked at the navigation catalogs again. A caution route would save her 5 days, but that really wasn't enough. Maybe the Boros pilots that ran the circuit all the time knew of a shortcut. She called up their time-on-route stats. Supposedly, they all took green-lined routes, but the on-time figures were improbably high for the Corian-Bizarre leg of the journey. They had a shortcut, she was sure of it. For the rich and beautiful daughter of Lord Thornbuckle, a stockholder, the secret wasn't that hard to find, a double jump point system where the 2 jump points had been stable for over 50 years. Fleet had warnings about systems harboring 2 jump points, but Fleet had warnings about everything. Brunn grinned to herself as she plotted a jump direct from Podge to the first of the double jumps. A nice slow V insertion in such a small mass vessel, and she would be safe as safe, and have plenty of time to visit Lady Cecilia. Jester slid through the first jump point and scan cleared. Brunn checked the references and grinned. The second jump point was right where it was supposed to be, an easy transit. She was tempted to make a flat run for it. Nothing else should be in system, but checked for beacons anyway. 4 popped up on the screen.
4?
She punched the readout. Up came Elias Madero, which should have cleared the system 3 days before, and 3 ships with non-familius registry. Barrican was staring at the scan monitor.
Jumpers out, now!
They won't notice us for another few minutes. Whatever's going on, we can find out and...
We're Scandalade too. They aren't where you see them, whoever they are. And it's trouble.
I can see it's trouble, but if we're going to get them help, we need to know what kind, who it is, what's going on.
Calvaro had come up behind her.
It won't help anyone if we're blown away. This thing can't fight, and we don't know what those are. They might outrun us.
We're little. They'll never even notice. A flea on the elephant.
Milady.
That did it. Her father's men protecting her father's daughter. They probably thought she would faint at the sight of blood. When would her father realize that she was grown, that she was capable?
We're going to sneak in closer and look, just look. Then we can jump out and tell Fleet what's happened.
That's foolish, milady. What if they...
If they're pirates, they'll think we're too small to bother with.
Brunn pushed back memories of that lecture on recent incursions from outlying powers. These were not the Benignity. She had seen Benignity ships on scan. Nor the Blood Horde, which was all the way across Familia space and probably still licking its wounds after the Kosciusko mess. These were common criminals, and common criminals were after the big, easy profit, not chasing a small yacht with a few insignificant passengers.
If you would jump out now, we could be back in range of the Corian Ansible in just a few hours.
And have nothing much to say. No, we need to record some data, at least the beacon IDs of those other ships.
Brunn grinned at them, and saw the grin have its usual effects. Her father's employees had been putty in her hands since she had convinced the head cook to give her all the chocolate eclairs she could cram into her mouth. Nor had she been sick, which only proved that the stuffier grown-ups were entirely too cautious. Sneaking nearer with the in-system drive just nudging them along was dead easy. Brunn napped briefly, slightly worried that one of them might figure out the lockout code she'd put on the nav computer so that they couldn't go into jump while she was asleep. But they hadn't. They'd tried. She could see that in their expressions, a mix of guilty and disgruntled. But she'd used a trick she'd learned at Copper Mountain, and it held. Scan delay was down to 1 minute by then. One of the mystery ships was snugged up to the Merchanter, and one was positioned a quarter second away. The third... Her breath caught. The third had moved. On an intercept course. It couldn't have seen Jester. The yacht was too small. They could have spotted the bobble near the jump point, but after that, she had laid in a straight course, and they could have extrapolated. She should have jinked about. In the back of her mind, a nagging voice told her that she should have done what Barrican said, and jumped out right away. The pirates could not possibly have caught her then. Now, if they had military-grade scans... She flicked off the lockout. She could jump from here. There were no large masses to worry about. She had no idea where they might come out, jumping this far from the mapped points, but it had to be better. She set up the commands and pushed the button. A red warning light came on.
There are no mapped jump points within critical. Jump insertion refused.
Brunn felt the blood rush to her face as she slapped the Jumpmaster control the other way. A rented yacht with standard navigation software. She had not thought about that, about the fail-safes it would have built in, which she would not have time to bypass. She looked at the in-system drive controls. The yacht's in-system drive, standard for this model, should be able to outrun anything but fleet's fastest, but only if she could redline it. She noticed that the control panel stopped well below what she knew was its redline acceleration. Still, it was all she had.
Milady.
Yes?
They might not have seen us, even so. If you don't do anything, they might miss us still.
And if they don't, we're easy meat. They've got the course. A preschooler could extrapolate our position.
But if we seem to be unaware of them, they might still consider us unimportant. If you do anything, they'll have to assume you've noticed trouble.
What she had noticed was how stupid she'd been.
Someday, you'll get into something you can't handle by being bright and pretty and lucky.
She'd assumed someday was a long way away, and here it was.
We have essentially no weapons, so our only hope of escape is to get within effective radius of that jump point. Unless, of course, they do ignore us, and somehow I don't think they will.
On scan, the other ship's projected course curved to parallel theirs. Another of the smaller ships now moved, and moved in the blink-stop way of a warship that could micro-jump within a system.
Oh, we can't outrun that. Two of them.
Just go along as if we had no scans out at all.
It was good advice. Brunn knew it was good advice. But doing nothing wore on her in a way that action never did. Second by second, Jester slid along much more slowly than it had to. Second by second, the unknown ships closed in. She wondered what kind of scan they had. Kutsudis had been able to detect activity aboard other ships. Could these? Would they believe that a little ship on a simple slow course from jump point to jump point would notice nothing? Seconds became minutes, became an hour. She had shut down active scan long since. Passive scan showed Elias Madero and the third unknown in the same relative location, with the other two flanking Jester. They were approaching the closest point to the Merchanter on their projected course to the second jump point. If they got by, if they weren't stopped, would that mean they were in the clear? There was no logical alternative. One could always choose certain death, but it was amazingly hard to do. So this was what Baron had faced. This was what the instructor had been talking about. Brunn dragged her mind back to the present. The yacht had a self-destruct capability. She could blow it, and herself, and her father's loyal men. Or she could force the raiders to blow their way in and not wear a pressure suit. That would do it. But she made herself look at the faces of the men who surrounded her, who were about to die for her, or with her.
I was wrong. No comfort now, but you were right, and I was wrong. I should have jumped right back out.
No matter, milady. We'll do what we can.
Which was nothing. They could die defending her, or be killed without fighting. She did not believe the raiders would spare them.
I think we should surrender. Perhaps...
Not an option, milady. That's not a choice you can make. We're sworn to your father to protect you. Go to your cabin, milady.
She didn't want to. She knew what was coming, and it was not death she feared, but having forced these men into a position where they had to die, would die, in a futile effort to protect her. I'm not worth it, she wanted to say, to admit. And she knew she must not say that. She must not take their honor from them. They thought her father was worth it, or... Again, Esme's words rang in her head. They thought they were worth it.
Giles Barrican, Hubert Calvero, Savoy Ardenil, Basil Verenchy, Saren Verenchy, Caspar Pronoth, Clara Pronoth, Piers Slavis, Litenia Biragan, Charon DeVoice.
She could find no words for them beyond naming them, recognizing their lives. She gave them all she had, a last smile, then went meekly to her cabin as they wished. It wouldn't work. She would die at the end, but they would not have to see her dead or captive. They could die remembering that smile for all the good it did, and she did not even know if they believed in an afterlife where such a memory might be comforting. She wrote their names over and over on many scraps of paper and tucked them in places she hoped the raiders would not find. They deserved more, but that was all she could do. When the cabin hatch gave at last, she faced the intruders with her personal weapons. The first one to try the opening fell twitching, but the small sphere they tossed in burst in a spray of needles, and she felt the fine stinging all up her body. Her hand relaxed, her sidearm fell, she felt her knees sagging, and the deck came up to meet her. Brunn woke with a feeling of choking, then realized a wad of cloth was tied in her mouth, a gag like something out of an ancient story. Ridiculous. She blinked and glared up at the men standing over her. They were in pea suits, helmets dangling in back. Her body still felt heavy and limp, but she could just move her legs when she tried. She tried to struggle, but the drug made it impossible. They dragged her upright, then out through the twisting hatch into the main passage of the yacht, over the bodies of her guardsmen, through the tube they'd rigged between the yacht and their ship, whatever it was. They pushed her into a seat and strapped her in, then walked off. Brunn wiggled as much as she could. Her arms, then her legs, began to itch and then tingle. So the drug was wearing off. But she didn't see how she could get away. Yet.
Your first duty is to stay alive.
Several more men came through the tube. Was that all? Or had some stayed aboard the yacht? And if so, why? She felt her ears throb as they shut the exterior lock, then the interior lock. They must have cast off the yacht. Someone would find it, someday. If another Boro ship came this way, if another Boro ship even noticed a minor bit of space debris... The ship she was on shuddered uneasily. Jump, then steadied again. Three of the men were still back by the airlock. Now they went to work. Brunn craned her head, trying to see. Her ears popped again. The men moved on into the airlock and undogged the outer hatch. Colder air gushed in, chilling her ankles. The ones who'd originally brought her aboard reappeared, now in some sort of tan uniform instead of pea suits, unstrapped her, and hauled her upright. If she could break loose, while they thought she was still weakened, but three more appeared at the airlock. Too many, her mind decided, even as her body tried to twist. Too much drug, she realized, as her muscles refused to give her the speed she was used to. Well, if she couldn't fight, she could at least observe. Tan uniforms, snug-fitted shirts over slightly looser slacks, over boots. Brown leather boots, she noticed when she looked down. On the collar, insignia of a five-pointed star in a circle. Once she was through the airlock, she saw the Boros Consortium logo on the bulkhead. So she must be on the Elias Madero. The men hustled her down the passage, wide enough for a small robot loader, past hatches with symbols and labels she felt she should recognize, past a galley, past a gymnasium, to the bridge. But the man who stood in the center of the bridge was no merchant captain. He had to be the commander. He wore the same uniform as the others, but the star in circle insignia on his collar was larger, and gold instead of silver. She met his gaze with all the defiance she could muster. He looked past her to her escort.
Got the papers?
One of the other men came forward with her ID packet.
Yep, she's one, all right. We checked her retinal scans and everything.
You done good, boys.
The commander glanced at her papers, then at her.
Not a single shred of decency, but what can you expect of that sort?
Brun struggled to spit out the gag. She knew exactly what she wanted to say to this person. The commander came closer.
You're that so-called speaker's daughter. You're used to having your own way, just like your daddy. Well, all things come to an end. You probably think your daddy'll get you out of this like he's gotten you out of all your other scrapes. You may think he's going to send that regular space service to rescue you, but it ain't going to happen that way. We don't want your daddy's money. We aren't scared of your daddy's power. They won't find you. No one's going to find you. You're ours now.
He grinned past her.
Your daddy and that council of families, they think they got a right to make the laws for everybody, but they don't. They think they got a right to set fees and taxes on everybody that comes through their so-called territory, but they don't. Free men don't have to pay any mind to what perverts and women say. That's not the way God made the universe. We're free men, we are, and our laws come from the word of God as set forth by the prophets.
They will destroy you. You can't do this. You won't get away with it. And they will come after me and blow you to bits.
He reached out to her face. And when she turned away, he grabbed her ears with both hands and forced her to face him.
Now, your daddy may try, or maybe because he'll know we've got you, he'll have the good sense to let us alone if he doesn't want to see his little girl in pieces. But he's not going to get you back. No one is. Your life just changed forever. You're going to obey like the prophet said women should, and the sooner you start, the easier it'll be on you.
Never.
Brun threw that at him with her eyes, with every fiber of her body. Maybe she couldn't do anything now, but now was not forever. She would get free, because she always did come out on top. She was lucky. She had abilities they didn't know about. But the fear edged closer.
Someday your luck will run out.
Someday you'll be helpless.
Someday you'll be stuck.
And what will you do then?
The words she had thrown at them sounded thin now, faced with these men. But she had meant them. She would not give up. She would not give in. She was Brunhilde Charlotte, named for queens and warriors. He moved his hands down the sides of her head to her neck.
You don't believe me yet. That's fine. Doesn't matter.
He slid his hands out her shoulders, then curled his fingers into the neck of her jumpsuit. Brun would have curled her lip if she could. Here it came, the predictable move of a story cube male captor. He was going to rip her clothes off. He would be surprised when he tried. She hadn't spent all that money for custom-tailored protective ship suits for nothing. But he didn't try to rip the suit, just ran his fingers inside the neck, feeling the cloth.
We'll need the slicer, boys.
Well, hackneyed but smarter than dirt, maybe.
The knife the other man handed him was large enough to gut an elephant, Brun thought. He wanted her to be impressed with it. Some men always thought bigger was better, but she had seen knives that big before.
Now, the first thing...
The man slid the tip of the long blade into the neck of her suit.
Women don't wear men's clothes.
Brun didn't see how anyone could mistake a custom outfit designed for her body as a man's outfit. With those darts, it wouldn't have fitted any male she'd ever seen.
Women who wear men's clothes are usurping men's authority. We don't put up with that.
He made a single rapid slice downward, and the ship suit opened from neck to crotch. He could just as well have pulled the tab, but he had to make a dramatic thing out of it, ruining an expensive ship suit.
Women are not allowed to wear trousers.
What do pants have to do with it?
Everyone wore pants if they were doing the kind of work in which pants were more comfortable. But this was probably just an excuse to cut her clothes off. He inserted the tip of the knife into the lower end of the opening and sliced open the leg of the ship suit. Then the other leg. Brunn stared ahead. They would want her to react. She wouldn't react.
Women are not allowed to wear men's shoes.
At a nod from the commander, two men grabbed her legs and pulled off her boots.
Stupid, stupid, stupid.
Custom-made boots, her boots. And she was a woman, and therefore those were women's boots, not men's boots. Then they dropped her legs. Her bare feet thudded on the cold deck. Next, the commander gestured, and someone behind her pulled the ripped sides of her ship suit behind her. This she'd expected. Her chin lifted.
Take a good look. You'll pay for every leer.
But the commander's frown was not a leer. He was staring at her abdomen, at the registered embryo logo with its imprinted genetic data.
Abomination. A construct.
One of the other men pulled out his own big knife, but the commander's gesture stopped him, just as Brunn was sure she would be gutted right there.
It's true that none of the faithful can tamper with God's plan for their children, but this woman is the result of tampering. What was done to her was not her responsibility.
Brunn relaxed muscles she didn't realize she'd tensed. The man leaned over, peering at the mark, then rubbed his finger over it. Brunn thought of kneeing him in the face, but there were still too many of them. She would have to wait.
I don't like it. What perversions have they bred into her?
None that'll survive our training. And she's strong, well-grown. By all reports, she carries genes for intelligence and good health. It'd be a waste not to make use of them.
But
she will be no threat to us.
He looked Brunn full in the face.
You are thinking still that you will be rescued, that you can go back to your abominations and perversions. You do not yet believe that your old life is over, but you will soon. You have already spoken the last words you will ever speak.
What does that mean? Are they going to kill me after all?
Brunn stared back, defiant.
You will be used as you deserve. And as a mute breeder, you will be no threat, no matter what.
Brunn felt a shock as her mind caught up with that.
I see you understand that much at least. You're not used to that, not being able to plead and beg and wheedle your way around your weakling father or the other men you've whored with. But that's over. The voice of the heathen will be heard no more. Yea, the tongues of those who know not God will be silenced. And as the holy words also say, women shall keep silence before men in respect and submission. You were born in sin and abomination, but you will live in the service of God Almighty. When it is time, when we choose, you will sleep. And when you awake, you will have no voice.
Her body jerked in spite of herself. She struggled, as she had not struggled before, knowing it was useless. Brunn fought herself to stillness, hating the tears that stung her eyes, that ran down her face.
We'll put you away now to think about that. I want you to know ahead of time, to understand. For this is part of the training you will receive, to learn that you have no power, and no man will listen to you. You are silenced, slut, as women should be silent.
It could not be happening. Not to her. Not to the daughter of the Speaker of the Grand Council. Things like this happened, if they happened, in dull history books, in times long past or places far away. Not to her. All this, she knew to her shame, was in her eyes, was in the tears, in the shaking of her body.
Take her back. Be sure you've cuffed her. Start an IV, too, just saline for now.
For now. For however long. She believed suddenly. It was real. It was happening. The men holding her moved her firmly along, her bare feet stumbling on all the rough places where her boots had protected her. She was cold, frozen with a fear she had never understood when she saw the story cubes or read the old books in her father's library. In the compartment, four of them laid her on the bunk, ignoring her struggles, and cuffed her hands to the sides, her feet together. She tried to plead with her eyes.
Oh, loosen the gag just for a minute, please. Please.
Another one came with a little kit and turned her arm, inserting the IV needle deftly. She stared up at the bag of saline hanging from a hook overhead.
When we're ready, we'll put you to sleep. Welcome to the real world.
She hated them. She writhed with fury. But it was too late for that. She would go to sleep. It would be a dream when she woke. A bad dream, a scary dream. And she would go tell Esme about it and apologize for having laughed at Esme. She would... Brun woke to a sense of pain and fought her way to consciousness. No gag in her mouth. She could breathe through it.
Did they?
But she could feel her tongue, too large it seemed, scrubbing around in her mouth. So they hadn't. At least not yet. She swallowed. Her throat felt raw and scratchy. She looked around cautiously. No one. She was still cuffed to the bunk, with the IV running in her arm, but no one was there. She took a breath of pure relief and froze in horror. No sound. She tried again and again. No sound but the rush of air in her throat, which hurt a lot now. She tried to whisper, at least, and realized that she could shape words, though moving her tongue made the pain in her throat worse. But she could get no real volume out, hardly enough sound to carry across a small room. Almost at once, the door slid aside, and the one who had inserted the IV came in.
You need to drink.
He held a straw to her mouth.
Swallow this.
It was cold, minty. She could swallow, but she could not say anything. Her throat hurt as the liquid went down, then eased.
You've realized what we've done. Cut your vocal cords, some muscles. Left your tongue. You can eat normally and swallow and all the rest of it. But no speech. And no, it won't grow back. Not the way we do it.
It had to be a dream. But she had never felt a dream this real. The cold air on her skin, the ache from being bound in one position too long, the pain in her throat, and the silence when she tried to speak. She tried to whisper, to mouth words, but at that, he put a hand on her mouth.
Stop that! You don't talk to man ever. Make faces at us, and you'll be punished.
It wasn't making faces, it was communication. How could he not know that?
Nothing you have to say is important to us. Later, if you're obedient, you can lip-speak to other women in the women's quarters, but not now, and never to men. Now, I'm going to examine you. Do as I say.
His examination was clinical and complete, but not brutal. He handled her body with the same smooth competence she had received from doctors in her father's clinics. He spoke the results aloud for a recorder. Brun learned that she was now catalogued as captive female 4, slut, gene-altered, fertile. Her instant satisfaction at the error in that disappeared when he held up her fertility implant, and she realized they had removed it. Through the haze of drugs, she now felt the pain in her left leg from the incision. She was fertile then, or soon could be, if they also knew about fertility drugs. She thought they probably would. When he was through, the man called others. They carried her from that compartment to another, somewhat larger, but empty of anything she could use as a weapon against them or herself. She was still cuffed, this time one arm to the corner of the bunk. Beside her, the men left a soft tube of nutrient gel and a carry sack of water. She had just dozed off when the commander appeared with the man who had waked her.
How long?
Well, she'll be strong enough in another 2 or 3 days, but she won't ovulate for another 12 to 14. I gave her the shots, but it takes that long to cycle.
We'll move her in with Gurley and the babies when she's strong enough. She can start sewing, though I doubt she knows any more about that than Gurley did.
He stepped up to the bunk.
Now, you know, we spoke truth. Living among liars as you did, you might have doubted us. Now, your next lesson. You aren't who you were. No one will ever call you by that heathen name you used. Where you're going, no one will even know it. Right now, you have no name at all. You're a slut because you aren't a virgin or a wife. Sluts are any man's pleasure. When you've borne your third child, if anyone wants you, and if you've been obedient, You will be available for junior wife.
He left, taking the other man with him, before she even thought to curse him in whispers. Brunn wanted to cry, but tears would not come. Instead, despair settled over her like a dark blanket, tucking itself around her mind until she could see nothing else. She struggled against it briefly, but it held her as firmly as the cuff on her arm, and she was so tired. She slept again and woke. Her throat hurt. She sucked at the nutrient tube, and the chill gel eased it again. The move to the other compartment had to be better. If she lay there alone, she would go crazy. Another human, even women belonging to these men, had to be better. Hazel looked up from the littles only as far as the men's waists. She saw the woman's bare legs and almost forgot to keep her gaze down. They had told her about this woman, and Hazel's heart had ached for her. But it frightened her, because they had shown Hazel pictures of what they'd done to her and threatened to do the same to Hazel and the littles if Hazel disobeyed. Now they pushed the woman down onto the pallet along the wall. Hazel pulled the littles back into the corner. The woman was pale, almost as white as milk, and dark bruises stood out on her skin. She had a rough red scar on her leg, and her face... Hazel didn't want to look at her face, but the burning blue eyes seemed to reach for hers and demand a response.
Girlie, you take care of her. Feed her. Make sure she eats and drinks and goes to toilet. Keep her clean. But don't talk to her. Understand?
Hazel bobbed her head. They'd told her and told her. If she talked to the woman they were bringing in, they'd do the same to her. And to both the littles. She couldn't let that happen.
You teach her to sew if she doesn't know how. Make her a decent dress. We'll bring more cloth.
Hazel bobbed her head again. The men left, leaving the strange woman alone. Hazel hitched herself across the deck, being careful not to uncover her legs, and retrieved the food sack. She held out a tube of paste concentrate. The woman put her hand in front of her mouth and turned away. Hazel went back to the littles, who were staring at the woman with wide eyes.
Who is she?
Shh, shh, shh.
No clothes.
Shh, shh, shh. Hazel handed the littles their dolls and started them on the dancing game she'd devised. Every word Brunn had said to Esme seemed etched on her skin in acid.
Simply a matter of practice. Just think of pistons and cylinders.
In the silence, in her mind, she apologized again and again, screaming the words she could not say.
Oh, how could I have been so wrong? So stupid. So arrogant. How could I have thought the universe was set up for my convenience?
Her body ached, raw and sore from waking to sleeping again. They had all used her, over and over, for days. How many days, she didn't know. Through one cycle at least, for she had bled heavily. They didn't touch her then, and would not even enter the compartment. Not until she was clean again. And then it started all over. When her breasts swelled up, sore to the touch, she winced away from one of them. He stopped.
Slut!
Then he prodded her breasts and moved away. She lay slack, uncaring. If it wasn't hurting right now, that was enough. Another one came. The one she now recognized, who was some kind of medic. He felt her breasts, took her temperature, and sampled her blood. A few minutes later, he grinned.
You're breathing. Good.
Good. That I'm carrying the child of one of those disgusting monsters.
He seemed to read her feelings in her face.
You won't be able to do anything unnatural. If you try, we'll confine you alone. Understand?
She glared at him, and he slapped her.
You're just pregnant, not injured. You'll answer appropriately when I ask you a question. Understand?
Against her will, she nodded.
Get dressed now.
Under his gaze, she fumbled back into the ugly tube-like dress the girl had made for her and tied the tapes that held it closed. She threw the square of cloth that covered her arms around her shoulders. They hadn't figured out yet how to put sleeves in the dress.
Come along.
He led her back to the compartment where the girl and the little ones waited. The girl looked at her, then looked away. Brunn wasn't sure how old the girl was. She looked very young, perhaps 11 or 12, but if she'd had an implant to retard puberty, she might be as old as 18. If only they could talk. even write notes back and forth. But there were no writing materials in the cabin, and the girl refused to talk, looking away when Brunn tried to mouth words at her. Day followed day, unbearable in their sameness. Brunn watched the young girl try to quiet and entertain the two little ones, feed them, keep the compartment clean. She was always gentle with the younger girls, always busy in her care for them. The girl accepted Brunn's help, but seemed afraid of her. When the girl held out food she had been ordered to give Brunn, she looked down or away. Brunn had no way of telling time, except by her body's growth. When she felt the first vague movement that could not be ignored, she burst into silent tears. After a while, she felt someone patting her head gently, and looked through tear-stuck lashes to see one of the babies, the one the girl called Stasi. The child put her head near Brunn's.
Don't cry. Don't cry.
Stasi, no!
That was the older girl pulling the child away. Brunn felt as if she'd been stabbed in a new way.
Does the girl think I would hurt the child?
She struggled to hold back the sobs, but couldn't. To get her mind off herself, she tried to pay more attention to the others, especially the older girl. The girl could not be one of them, not originally. She sewed clumsily with no real knowledge of how to fit cloth to human shapes. When the men dropped off garments to be mended, Brunn could see that they had been made originally with great skill, with hand sewing, like the most expensive folk imports, the stitches subtly imperfect. Surely a girl of their people would know by that age how to do it right. She glanced at the girl, whose brown hair hung down like a curtain to either side of her face. She didn't even know the girl's name. The men always called her Girlie, and the little ones Baby. If the girl wasn't one of theirs, where had she come from? No clues now. The pullover that formed the top of her dress might have come from anywhere, one of the millions sold in a mid-price shop at any spaceport. Spaceport? Had she been snatched off a space station or a ship? By the color of her skin and hair, by her features, she could have come from any of 100 planets, off any of 1,000 ships. And yet, she was herself an individual, just as Brunn was. She had a past. She had hoped for a future. Ordinary, but very real. Brunn found herself imagining a family for the girl, a home, wondering if the little ones were her sisters or just other captured children.
How does the girl stand it?
Tears choked her again. She clenched her hands to her swelling belly. The girl flashed her a quick look, wary. Then, for the first time, she reached out a hand and patted Brunn's. That did it. Brunn cried harder, rocking back and forth. Some days after boosting the trader on its way, Shrike nosed into the spin-down military docking collar at Overhold, the larger of the two orbital stations serving Bizarre, as gently as a spider landing on a tree. Esme carried out the docking sequence under Solus's watchful eye. It was her first docking. Everything went smoothly. Solus nodded as the status lights flicked to green and then opened a channel to the station master.
RSS Shrike docked. Permission to unseal?
Permission to unseal. All personnel leaving ship must be ID'd at the security desk opposite the docking bay.
Understood, Station Master. We anticipate a brief visit and no station liberty. My quartermaster will be coming out to arrange for some supplies.
Right, Shrike. You do have a hard copy packet in the tank?
Thank you, sir. Idiot civilians. Says that right out on the station comm where anyone with a halfway decent data suck could get it.
He turned to Esme.
Lieutenant, you'll take the bridge while I'm on station picking up our mail. I anticipate being gone less than an hour. If I'm delayed, I'll call you.
Sir.
Esme toggled the internal comm.
Security escort to the Axis for the captain on the double.
And I think we'll do a practice scan as well. Nobody's checked Overhold since Hearn was by, and there's no reason to trust her data. You can set that up while I'm gone.
Nothing showed up on the scan by the time Solus returned, and he sent Esme off to other routine duties. Half a shift later, Chief Arbuthnot came back from the station in a state of annoyance and reported to the cook while Esme was in the galley inspecting the sink traps.
Oh, they don't have any Arbuthnot marmalade in, and we need it for the captain's birthday dinner. I always get it here. It's better quality than out of stores at HQ. They say they don't expect any until the Boros circuit ship comes in.
The cook glanced up at a schedule on the bulkhead.
Well, that's odd. Wasn't that ship supposed to be in already? We usually get here a week or so after her.
Yes, but she's not. They don't sound very worried, though.
Esme reported that conversation, minus the specifics of a treat for the captain's birthday, to Captain Solis.
They don't seem concerned. Interesting. I think perhaps we'll have a word with the Boros shipping agent here.
The Boros agent, a flat-faced woman of middle age, shrugged off Captain Solis's concern.
You know yourself, Captain, that ships are not always on time. Captain Lunn is getting on a bit. This was to be his last circuit. But we're confident in his honesty.
It's not his honesty I'm questioning, but his luck. What was his percentage of late arrivals?
Lund? He's better than 93% on time, and in the last 5 years, 100% on time.
Which you define as?
Within 24 hours, dock to dock.
On all segments?
Well, let me check. Yes, sir. In fact, on the segment ending here, he's often 12 to 24 hours early.
When would you have reported an overdue ship if we hadn't asked?
Company policy is to wait 3 days, 72 hours for any run, and add another day for each scheduled 10 days. For Elias Madero, on this segment, that would come to 10 days altogether. And from day before yesterday, when she was due, that's 7 days from now.
Captain Solis called Esme into his office as soon as he'd returned.
You see the problem. Scheduled transit time is 72 days from Corian to Bazaar, dock to dock. Most of that time spent on in-system drive. If you consider beacon-to-beacon time, she should have been off-scan only 16 days.
What's the scan data from Corian?
Normal exit from system. The approved course was like this.
Solis pointed it out on the charts.
That makes the scheduled transit fairly tight. If the company schedules things that tight, then it makes sense to allow some overage. But I'd expect someone on this route to be over the allotted time at least 30% of the time. And the Elias Madero wasn't. Does that tell you anything?
They've been using a shortcut. They'd have to.
Right. Now we have to figure out where.
Someone at Boros should know.
Yes. But if it's an illegal transit, unmapped or something, they may not want to tell us. Tell me, Lieutenant, who would you recommend for a little quiet questioning?
The crew list ran through Esme's mind, unmarked by any helpful notes on deviousness. She hadn't been with them long enough to find out. She fell back on tradition.
I would ask Chief Arbuthnot, sir.
Good answer. Tell him we need someone who would be confused with a shady character. Someone who can get answers out of a rock by persuasion.
Chief Arbuthnot knew exactly what Esme wanted and promised to send young Darren out at once. The answer that finally came back several days later was expected, but not overly helpful.
A double jump system. Let's see if we can get confirmation out of someone at Boros. They probably ran into a shifting jump point.
Why would someone retiring risk that?
He probably thought it was stable. Some of those systems are stable for decades, but that doesn't mean they're safe.
If they were carrying contraband, then the time gained in a shortcut would give them time to offload it. Or, if someone knew they had contraband, it'd make a fine spot for an ambush.
Solis raked a hand through his hair.
Well, we'd better go take a look and see. I have to hope it's not a shifting jump point.
By this time, the local Boros agent was quite willing to list the Elias Madero as missing. Even so, it took Solis another 2 days to locate someone higher in the Boros administration who could confirm not only the existence, but the location of the shortcut.
There's an off odor about this whole thing. Normally, I'd expect reluctance to admit to using a dangerous route, but there's something more. Or less. I'm not sure. Now, how would you plot a course to this place?
It was not, Esme discovered, a simple matter. The shortest route would have been to reverse what the trader's course would have been, but fleet charts did not list any insertion data for the outbound jump point.
Besides, if we go in that way, we'll cross any trail they made. We need to come in the way they did.
But that'll take much longer.
Solis shrugged, a gesture which did nothing to mitigate the tension of his expression.
Whatever happened has already happened. My guess is that it happened days before we got to Bazaar. So what matters now is to find out what happened in as much detail as possible. That means approaching the system with all due caution.
All due caution meant spending 23 days jumping from Bazaar to Podge to Corian, and from there to the shortcut jump points. Esme set up each course segment, and each time Solis approved. Shrike eased its way into the system with what Esme hoped would be low relative velocity. So it proved. And as scan steadied, she could see that the system held no present traffic. The senior scan tech pointed to the display.
But over here, Lieutenant, there's some kind of mess. I can't tell if it's distortion from interaction of the two jump points or leftover stuff from ships. If it's ships, it's more than one.
Esme looked at the scan herself. Ripples and blurs obscured what should have been a steady starfield.
What's the range?
Impossible to say right now, Lieutenant. We don't know how large it is, so we can't get a range. But to me, the texture looks closer to this than the other jump point.
The scan tech glanced at the captain.
We'll continue on course for 2 hours, then see what Parallax gives us.
In 2 hours, the area of distorted scan was hardly larger.
Well, Lieutenant, we can risk a micro jump, run in a few light seconds, and see what happens. Or we can sneak up on it. What's your analysis of the relative risk?
Esme pointed to the scan display.
Sir, this knot in the grav readings ought to be the second jump point. And if it is, it hasn't shifted. Nor has this one. Which suggests that we're definitely looking at transit residue. And therefore, unless it's an entire Benignity battle fleet, it's not that big. So it's close, but not within a light minute. We could jump in 15-second increments and have a safe margin.
If it's only transit residue, you're right. If it's also debris, it's been expanding from its source, and we don't know the location of its source. At some velocity, we also don't know, for at least, I'd say, 30 days. Worst case, Elias Madero was carrying the missing weapons, and for some reason, they all detonated. How much debris, and how big a volume are we talking about?
Esme fed numbers into the calc subunit as fast as she could.
I don't know, sir.
Nor do I. And that's why we'll jump in 1-second bursts with the main shields on full.
Solus brought Shrike toward the anomaly in repeated small jumps. At 21 light seconds in, the scan was markedly different. Now they could see clearly that more than one ship had been involved.
Let's just sit here and look at this.
On in-system drive, Shrike was hardly sitting still, but it would still take her hours to reach the distortion.
Do we have any indication at all of an original track?
Very attenuated, sir, but this might be the Merchanter's original trace.
Scan switched filters and enhancement to pick out, in pale green, a faint, widened trail.
If we take the center line of that, we get appearance at the incoming jump point, and progress consistent with an in-system drive of its class up to this point. But there's a more recent trace, much smaller.
So, assume for the moment that we have found the Merchanter's incoming trace and it's a perfectly straightforward course toward the second jump point, just as they've done before. There's no bobble indicating slowdown until the mess?
None, Captain. But the traces are so old, I can't be sure.
Right. But I'm assuming that for now. She comes in, she heads for her outbound jump, and runs into a bunch of other ships. Trouble, no doubt. Do we have any older traces?
No. And from this angle, it'd be hard to see them.
Fine, we'll go up and take a look there.
Solus put his finger on the chart.
A 32-second jump to these coordinates. I want to be well outside the zone of distortion.
Scan blurred and steadied again.
Now, I want to find out where those other ships came from and in what order.
Esme found this tedious, but knew better than to say so. Surely the fastest way to find out what had happened to the Elias Madero would be to go in and look. The system was empty. What could be wrong with that? The scan tech raised her hand.
Captain, the Merchanter, or the ship that made the incoming trace, left by the second jump point.
What?
Yes, sir, look here. There's 5 outbound traces. 3 maybe patrol-sized craft, 1 very small. My guess is it's whatever little ship overlay the Merchanter's trace on the way in, and the big one, the Merchanter itself.
Then why hasn't it shown up?
They... Raiders don't steal entire ships, do they?
Not often, but if she was carrying weapons, they might. Let's think this through. We have 1 large ship. We're assuming for now it was the Boro ship, coming in, running into something, and then leaving by the second jump point. 1 little ship sometime later following it in and out.
Excuse me, Captain, but the little ship's departure trace is the same age as the others. Within a few minutes, anyway.
So they had arranged a cleanup? Someone to follow behind and make sure the Merchanter went through? But then we still don't know who the other 3 ships were, which way they came in. Any other traces?
More color shifts on the scan monitor as the tech cycled through all the enhancement possibilities. Suddenly, three pale blue tracks showed up, angling from the second jump point to make a wide circuit and end up positioned along the Merchanter's track.
There they are, sir. Came in by number two, and set up an ambush, looks like.
So I see. Good job, Quinn. Well, that seems clear enough. Someone knew the Merchanter was coming and wanted it. Someone came in and set up either an ambush or a rendezvous. Now, Lieutenant, we'll go in and see what evidence we can pick up.
The first evidence was a scatter of what was clearly debris.
So the ship blew? Or was blown?
The scan tech pointed out figures along the side of the screen.
No, not enough debris. I've been keeping track of the estimated total mass of all fragments, and it's less than would fit into one of the five cargo holds of the freighter we're hunting. Moreover, if it was from an explosion, it would be much more scattered by now. This was dumped from something with very low relative V, perhaps given just a little push in addition. My guess is that someone captured it and took it.
She reset one of the fine-grain scans.
Let's see if we can find any bodies.
Hour after hour, then day after day, the painstaking work went on. The SAR ship located and identified one piece of debris after another, all the while plotting location and vector on a 3D display. Hundreds, thousands of items. And then, the bodies they had known must be there, that they had both hoped and feared to find. They gathered the bodies into one of the vacuum bays, tagging them with numbers, the order in which they were retrieved. Men, women, the men in ship suits, with their names stenciled on back and chest, as expected, the women.
Their tongues have been cut out, and they're naked. I can't tell out here if it was done before or after death.
I never heard of the Blood Horde making it into this sector.
This isn't Blood Horde work. They mutilate males as well, and this isn't their typical mutilation anyway.
Lieutenant Vanoia Harrell, Major Bannon's assistant, piled the items on the table. Bannon himself was in the morgue, working on the recovered bodies.
All these things were all marked and recorded in place. Now we need to know what they tell us about the crew and the raiders.
Didn't Boros give us a crew list?
Yes, but crew lists aren't always dead accurate. Someone gets sick or drunk and lays off for a circuit, or someone's kid comes along for the ride.
Children?
Usually. Commercial haulers often have children aboard, especially those on stable runs like this. We haven't found any juvenile bodies yet, which doesn't mean anything either way. They're smaller and less likely to be picked up. We're still missing five adult bodies, including the captain. Let's see here.
Harrell started sorting items into classes.
ID cases, put those down at the end. Grooming items, recording devices, aha. No, do things in order, but I can hope that this recorded something useful.
Here's a child's toy.
It was a stuffed animal, in blue and orange, well chewed by some child. She didn't want to think about the fate of those children on the Merchanter. She had to hope they were dead.
Good. Stick it over there, and anything else that looks like it belongs with children. Where was it found?
In the back pocket of a man whose ship suit reads, Jules Armitage.
Probably picked it up off the deck where some youngster dropped it. How was he killed?
Shot in the head. Record doesn't say with what.
The Major will figure that out. Oh, here's something.
Harrell held up a hand comp.
We might get some useful data off that if they used it for anything but figuring the odds in a horse race. Did you have background in scan?
When they had cataloged the items, Harrell began examining them.
You don't know how to do this yet, so I'll give you the easy stuff. See if any of those cubes have data on them. They're pretty tough, but the radiation may have fried them.
The first cube seemed to be a record of stores usage by the crew over the past 8 voyage segments. It listed purchases and inventory levels with all dates. The second, also dated, was from environmental. A complete record of the environmental log covering 30 days, 6 months before.
One of a set. But it gives us some baseline to go on. If you find the one that should have been running when the ship was taken. It suggests they blew the ship, but there's not enough debris.
It was found in... caught in the crevice of a lifeboat seat, the record says.
Well, someone tried to take the environmental log aboard a lifeboat, and the lifeboat was blown. That makes sense. They may have put all the logs aboard it.
Why would that be on a Merchanter?
Environmental log, automatic. Captain's log, how the voyage was going, and so on, and might include the cargo data. Accounting, which would definitely include the cargo data. Pay information. Crew list, medical, pretty sparse on a vessel like this with a stable crew. Communications log, but some Merchanters put that in the captain's log.
Esme slotted the next cube into the reader.
This looks like communications. And the date's recent. Fits with the ship's last stop. Elias Madeira to Corian High Site, Station Master. To traffic control. Undock and traffic transmissions and receptions.
Good. Let me see.
Harold came over and peered at the screen.
Oh, this is really good. We can match this against the records at Corian and see if anyone's tampered with the log. I wish they'd put it in full record mode, but that does eat up cube capacity. Let's just see how far it goes.
Elias Madeira, you get your captain to the comm. You surrender your ship and we'll let the crew off in your lifeboats.
My God, someone had the sense to turn on full record mode when the raiders challenged him.
The screen flickered. An image formed of a stern man in tan. Esme thought it might be a uniform, but she couldn't tell.
This is Captain Lund. Who are you and what the hell do you think you're doing?
A shift in the picture to show a stocky, balding man who was recognizable from the crew list. It was definitely Lund. The recording continued, including Lund's off-transmission commands to his crew. Harold paused the playback and sat back.
Well, now we know what happened to this ship, and we know they had kids and hid them. Question is, did the raiders find them, take them?
Must have.
Esme felt sick at the thought. Four preschoolers, the age she had been when... She pushed that away, but was aware of a deep rage stirring to action. The person who had had the sense to put this cube in the lifeboat, who had thought to switch to full-mode recording, had also quickly shot Vid from the children's records. So they knew the children's names and had faces to go with them. Two girls, sisters. Two boys, cousins.
Well, the vid quality is good enough that we should be able to read the insignia on those uniforms. See if Intel has anything on them. Faces, we may have them in the file somewhere, and that's the most audio we've ever had from raiders. Interesting accent.
But all Esme could think about was the children. The helpless children. She turned the orange and blue toy over and over in her hands. One by one, the rescue crews located and retrieved the bodies.
We've got too many bodies. How many were on the Merchanter's crew?
So some raiders died. I'm not grieving.
These men have been stripped, not like the others. Would the raiders have stripped and dumped their own dead?
Unlikely. Stripped, you say? Why these men?
Dunno, but there's no ID on them at all. We can take tissue samples, but you know what that's like.
No fingerprints, retinals?
No, all burned. After death, the medic says. They died of combat wounds.
Solas turned to Esme.
Ideas, Lieutenant?
Unless we've stumbled into some local fighting ground, no, sir.
The Merchanters look like ordinary spacers. Light-boned, small body mass. Merchanters nearly always run with low grav because it feels good. Varying ages. The cook was 2 years older than the captain, all the way down to the kid.
The scrawny teenager who'd been in a fight before he was shot.
But these others, they could be fleet. Except that they don't have fleet IDs. Look at the muscular development. And their bone mass indicates regular hard exercise in a substantial field. At least standard G. Even though the raiders burned off the fingerprints, we can see enough callus structure on the hands that's consistent with weapons use.
Assuming it was the raiders, why wouldn't the raiders want them identified? If their primary target was the Merchanter, which seems obvious, and they left the crew identifiable, what was it about these?
Don't know. Military? Not fleet? A Benignity spy ship, maybe? A probe from the Guernsey? But why would the raiders care if we knew that? Unless they're from the same source, but that would imply that these are their people, and we've already said they probably aren't. About all we can be sure of is that they weren't Merchanter crew.
We can't do a genetic scan?
Well, we could, if we had one of the big sequencers. The forensic pathology lab at Sector would have one, but that still doesn't tell you much. I'm running the simpler tissue scales here, but I don't expect anything to come up. If someone reports missing persons and has their genome on file, that would do it.
We're finding less each sweep. Time to move on. This jump point has how many mapped outlets?
5, sir.
All right, we'll hop to Bazaar, where the Merchanter was headed, and report to Boros on what we found. I don't expect to find any trace there. We'd have noticed it when we were there before. So we'll have to let HQ decide if they want us to check each of the other known outlets or send someone else. Prepare a draft report for Sector HQ, and we'll pop that onto the Bazaar Ansible when we get there. Include a recommendation to interdict this route and a request for surveillance of all the outlets. Not that it will do any good,